Hey, what's going on? This is Curtis Granderson, the Grandy Man. You're listening to Baseball and Barbecue. Come hungry, not only for the knowledge, but for some great food. And you're definitely going to leave out full. Tune in to check out all the great stories I was on. I'm loving it. I can't wait to continue to eat and keep talking baseball.
Is your dad a big fan of smoked, grilled, and barbecued food? If so, I've got some great gift ideas for you that will knock this Father's Day out of the park. So stay tuned. Coming up on this episode of the Baseball and Barbecue Podcast, we've got some fantastic grill and grilling accessory gift ideas that we're going to discuss in our first ever The Griller's Guide to Father's Day. Stay tuned.
From Long Island in the Baseball and BBQ Studios, I'm Jeff the Oku Cohen, and that's Leonard Hollywood Aberman, and we're here for episode 241. Leonard!
Wow, Jeff, 241. I am thrilled to tell you that we have a very special episode. First, we have a returning guest. Actually, Jeff, we have two returning guests.
We do.
Yeah, because Mitchell Nathanson is an author, and his book is Under Jackie's Shadow. Voices of Black Minor Leaguers Baseball Left Behind. It's sad, you know, to read this and these players that could have been in the major leagues but weren't. But we get into a great talk, you know, with Mitchell.
It's not a fun book. It's an important book, though. It's something that baseball fans should read about, should know the history. I mean, everything wasn't rainbows and sunshine when after Jackie Robinson came into the league. I mean, it was still struggles. And this book explores 13 of those players who, you know, had struggles.
Yeah. And then, you know what, Jeff? After listening to that, a lot of people are going to want to get that book, whoever they're giving gifts to for Father's Day, right? But if they don't, then they're going to want to listen to the interview with Ray Sheehan as he gives us a fantastic Father's Day gift guide.
Absolutely.
But before we get to all of that, let me tell everybody that BetOnline is your number one source for the NBA and NHL playoffs this season. Every stat, every matchup, and even live odds while the games are being played. When the game's over, head on over to our online casino and get in on a game of blackjack or poker or unwind with one of our over 150 slot games. Head to the website today to get in on the action. Don't forget to use promo code BLEAV, that's BLEAV, for your 50% welcome bonus on your first deposit. Bet online, it is where the game starts.
And then, how are we starting?
Let's get right to it. We've got Mitchell Nathanson discussing his latest book, Under Jackie's Shadow, Voices of Black Minor Leaguers Baseball Left Behind.
This guest was with us back on episode 70, talking about his book, Boughton, The Life of a Baseball Original. He is back with a new book called Under Jackie's Shadow, Voices of Black Minor Leaguers Baseball Left Behind. This book is a portal into the world of minor league baseball in an era after Jackie Robinson. What was it like playing in the minor leagues while navigating the prejudices and hardships just because of the color of their skin? This is a first-person account of 13 players who endured the trials and tribulations of playing during this time. Mitchell Nathanson is a professor of law at Villanova University School of Law. He is the author of several books, including the aforementioned Boughton, also God Almighty Himself, The Legacy of Life and Legacy of Dick Allen, and A People's History of Baseball. Welcome back to Baseball and BBQ, Mitchell.
Welcome.
Thanks for having me.
You know, Mitchell, before we start with the book, I want you to know that I know in the acknowledgments or in the epilogue, you talk about how you wanted to, you wrote this book in kind of like the way Lawrence Ritter wrote it in The Glory of Their Times. I was at a book signing the other day, and I ran into Randy Ringler, who happens to be the niece of Lawrence Ritter, and we just talked about it, and I said, I'm talking to the guy who wrote a book in his style. So I thought that was, you know, just apropos. So,
yeah, well, you know, he kind of set the bar for these types of books, you know, at least in terms of baseball books, right? There's a fair number of books that are kind of in that style, though it's not easy to approach what that book was.
Right. No, that was a classic, obviously.
Yeah.
Reading this book, this is a great book, I got to tell everybody. An important book, I would say. Very heart-wrenching book, but an important one to read. And Under Jackie's Shadow, what was the impetus to write a book like this?
Well, I guess the idea didn't really come from me as much as it came from somebody that I had written briefly about in the Dick Allen book, the guy named Mickey Bowers, who I didn't interview for the Allen book. And instead, I had just come across his scouting, I don't know if you call this a scouting report, but it's like, you know, in the minor leagues, at the end of each season, the manager or a coach will write a little report and send it in to the organization. And I guess they use that at the end of the year to determine who gets brought up and who gets moved on, who gets released, all that stuff. Well, so when I was doing the Allen book, I thought what I would do is go to the Bob Carpenter archives, which are at the Hagley Museum in Wilmington. And so that's only about half an hour from me. So I just drove down there and I was actually looking for Dick Allen stuff. And all of the Dick Allen stuff had been removed from the Carpenter archives, I'm sure, because of probably a fair amount of unflattering things said and written about Dick Allen in the Phillies organization. So the archive was wiped clean of anything having to do with Dick Allen. But when I went through those cards, I found a card of this guy named Mickey Bowers, who I had never heard of. And I actually only played about a year in the Phillies organization in 1970. His report, his little card, said something. It mentioned Allen. That's how it caught my attention. And it said that, you know, you have to watch out for this guy. You know, Dick Allen is his idol. He'll stand up, he'll fight for his rights. We don't need another one like this. That's something like that. And then he got released. I looked him up. He hit like 300 that year. He played like a ball, but he had a good season. And that was the end. So I mentioned that in the book. And then a few years later, I was contacted by him. Eventually I got put into touch with him. He mentioned that anything that happened to Allen, you know, I wrote about all the stuff that happened to Allen in Little Rock and all the stuff that he went through in the minor leagues and then even in the majors once he got to Philadelphia. He says, yeah, that was all horrible. He says, but you have to understand that Allen had otherworldly talent. And on top of that, he was the recipient of what was the largest signing bonus, I think, in at least Phillies history, if not major league history at the time. It was like $75,000. This was before the draft. And so he said, well, you know, the Phillies, as terribly as they treated him, they had a vested interest in him. And so he was still going to move on. You know, it wasn't going to be easy for him, but he was going to move on. He says, but there were a lot more guys like Mickey Bowers than there were Dick Allen. And he said, nobody knows the stories of the guys like Mickey Bowers, because if you don't have that talent, you get flushed out of the system. And he says, and then you just disappear. He said, so at least for Allen, he said, well, Allen made it and everybody knows his story. For every Dick Allen, there's hundreds of guys like Mickey Bowers. And he said that people ought to know their stories. So anyway, I didn't really quite know what to do with that because for the very basic reason that nobody knows who Mickey Bowers is, who's going to want to read a story about Mickey Bowers? Right. It's a story about Dick Allen. You can sell that story. People are going to read a story about Dick Allen. But the story, God Almighty himself, the story of Mickey Bowers, you couldn't even find a publisher for it. And so the question I had was, well, what do I do with it? When he told me, we then started talking about all the experiences that he had. And I thought that his stories and his recollections were really great, fascinating, and important. And I thought that, yeah, he's right. People should know about this, but how do you do that? And so I came upon this idea that I would sort of do like an oral history of this. I wasn't quite sure how, but I knew that it would have to be a collection of players to see what I could find and then figure out how to organize it later. And so that's how it turned out. And as I was going through it, I wasn't quite sure how to organize it. And there's different ways you can organize it. Now Ritter does it by player. So if you go through Glory of the Times, he has a chapter for each player, which is what I did. But there's also other oral histories that don't go by an individual. They'll go by a subject matter or they'll go by something else. And I could have done it like that, but then I found that of all the people I interviewed, there were 13 players that I thought had really, really compelling narratives that had a beginning, middle, and an end. And so I thought that rather than group them by subject matter, maybe something will get lost, I thought the humanity of the stories will come through more clearly if I gave each of those 13 players their own chapter. And that's what I did.
The book is, I think it's very important. These oral histories are extremely important because these may be players that will, you know, never tell their story. And it's important. And I think that it's good that you wrote this because it makes you think. You read these guys' stories. And let me just tell everybody again that it's called Under Jackie's Shadow, Voices of Black Minor Leaguers Baseball Left Behind. You start the book by having Jackie Robinson was honored. I think one of the games of the World Series, it was like 25 years after he broke the color barrier. I think a lot of people probably thought, oh, he broke the color barrier, baseball's integrated again, and, you know, all is good with the world. And as you start the book out, Jackie Robinson, who died like 9 days after that event, was not too happy with the fact that there was not a black manager in baseball. And it doesn't seem like he was too happy yet with how baseball was dealing with race issues, even though he was the first.
Yeah, I met Ron Rappaport, who met Robinson in 72 and then wrote a piece on it. And he wrote a piece in the L.A. Times recently about about meeting Jackie Robinson. So I got to be friendly with him and I was able to talk to him. And I use some of his work, some of his articles to help me tell that story since he met Robinson and had a lot of information that other people didn't have. And so I thought that was really helpful in understanding just how ambivalent Robinson was over all the celebration that was being, I don't know if it's a celebration. I mean, they honored him before the game. He had a very difficult relationship with the Dodgers because he really was embittered by the time he was done playing and he didn't see a lot of progress, even though baseball was touting this idea that they had progressed. And of course they had. I mean, you know, the fact that Robinson was there is right. Indicative that they had progressed, but as Robinson liked to point out, there were no black coaches, there were no black managers, there were no black people in the front office. And he said, well, until that happens, it's never going to be a situation where there's really full equality and full opportunity. And so he was already ambivalent about all these ideas about celebrating his integration of the game because he didn't think they had done enough. And very few people wanted to hear it. And even his Dodger teammates, Don Newcomb, I mentioned in the intro, Don Newcomb, who at that point was some sort of an ambassador to the former to the Dodger alumni, who reached out to Robinson. Newcomb would try to cover over all of this this anger that Robinson had by saying he was angry about other things or he was sorry that he was angry for all these years, and Robinson wasn't, and he was very upset that people like Don Newcomb, Don Newcomb were trying to apologize for him when he didn't want to apologize. You know, as I write in that introduction, he does use that ceremony to really take a dig at Major League Baseball and Bowie Kuhn, who are on the field with him, by just pointing out that, you know, here we are, it's 25 years later, but I don't see a black manager or black coaches or anything like that. And, you know, when we have that, then, we can, you know, then I'll celebrate. And of course, that he died just about, I think, as you said, 9 days later. So that didn't happen. And I thought that was a really good entry point to the book, because these are players who, the 13 players that I focus on are players who played at least a full generation after Robinson. These are guys from the 60s and some of them into the 70s. And I'm pretty sure that most people, even probably hardcore baseball fans at that point, probably weren't thinking that baseball had a racial problem in the 60s and the 70s, particularly in the 70s, when I think that was like the high point of black participation in the major leagues. At some point, there's like 18% African-American participation in the major leagues, which is, I think, as high as it had ever been. That was like the early 70s by that point. But there was this going on still. And it was going on in the minor leagues, also in the major leagues. But you can really see it in the minors with these guys. And I think, interestingly, a lot of the players that I spoke to, they came from middle-class integrated backgrounds. They didn't experience a lot of racism in their lives until they got into baseball. I don't think people, I don't think a lot of people who are coming to this would expect that. They would think, oh, well, maybe these are guys who dealt with racism their whole life. And a lot of these guys are like, no, we didn't. A lot of these guys are from California. They, Mickey Bowers, for example, who grew up as an army brat. He grew up in Germany on a military base. And he said, I didn't know anything about the civil rights movement other than I knew there was one. But he came back to America and he started playing. And there he saw racism. And he never saw that before.
Right. Never saw it in Germany.
Yeah. And a lot of these guys said similar things. Like, there may have been things here and there, but not too much. It was only when they got into professional baseball that they really saw the deep-seated racism. And not just in the South. Some saw it in the Midwest, in California, in the North, the Northeast, everywhere.
Well, Mitch, you have one player in the book who said I was in a group of the African-American players, and we were told, you know, you have to be the best of this group because nobody here is beating out a white player. And I forget who that was, but that was telling.
Yeah, he was in the Seattle Pilots organization. So they were only there for a year, and he went to spring training, and that's exactly what happened. He went to spring training and he thought he was doing well. And then they some coach called in all of the black players who were in camp and told him, well, you're competing with each other. You're not competing against the white guys. And he was stunned by that. And he would wonder, like, what country am I living in? What's going on here? And because, again, in 1969, we're 22 years post Jackie Robinson.
Right. Yes. And, we're talking about 70s where you had 18% of African-American players. And look, they had some great, great players in the 70s. And you look at the All-Star teams and it was just fantastic. Willie Stargell and those guys and Dave Parker. And just the list goes on and on. Ken Griffey and George Foster. You know, you focus on 13 people in the book. We're not going to talk about everyone because obviously you want to sell some book. But you did mention Mickey Bowers. But there's also one I found very interesting. Will Aaron, the cousin of Hank Aaron, with bloodlines and all that. You think this guy was pretty good. And I believe he was a second baseman, but managers or the organization did not want him to play second base because all black players played the outfield, not the infield.
Right. And he, as he said to me, I was drafted as a middle infield. I was drafted as a second baseman and shortstop. And he said, as a middle infielder, I was a decent prospect. And interesting that a lot of these guys were, but all the guys that I spoke to, none of them were delusional. None of them thought they were Dick out. But a lot of them were like, well, I could have had a chance. I could have at least advanced further. Maybe I wouldn't have been a star. Maybe I wouldn't have even been a starter. Maybe I wouldn't have made it. But I know I could have advanced further. And that was Will Aaron's story, because he said, look, as a middle infielder, I could compete. I could compete with other middle infielders. But when you put me in the outfield, you're looking for different things. You're looking for power. You're looking for speed. You're looking for things that maybe he didn't have as a middle infielder. And so they would keep pushing him out of the middle infield. They keep pushing him out of second base and put him in the outfield. And he said, well, once you're in the outfield, now I'm not competing against Roger Metzger and Bud Harrelson. I'm competing against guys like Dave Winfield. And he says that when you do that, he says that you completely change the game. And they would tell me I'm not advancing. I'm not meeting expectations. And he would say, well, of course I'm not. If you put me in the outfield, I'm not that kind of a player. I'm a middle infielder. I'm not an outfielder. And as you mentioned, he is Hank Aaron's cousin. And at one point he called Aaron, who was at that point had an executive position after he had just retired. And according to Will Aaron, Hank Aaron didn't really want to take his call because I think, you know, that stir up a whole bunch of things there. And also he also went to Frank Robinson and Frank Robinson, you know, when he explained what happened, Frank Robinson immediately said, oh, I know exactly what you're talking about because they do this all the time. Will Aaron was, I thought, really interesting in talking about how this positional segregation, it still occurs today. And one player he brought up was Mookie Betts. And he said, well, Mookie Betts was a second baseman. They moved him to the outfield. Now Mookie Betts has the power and it worked out great. But Mookie Betts is a Hall of Fame caliber player. And not everybody is going to be able to switch from the middle infield to the outfield like a Mookie Betts. He also mentioned that we talked to other players. I think one of the players he mentioned was, I think, Ron Washington and also Gary Templeton, who they also tried to move out of the middle of the infield. And he told them, don't do it. Don't let them do it because you have a shot as a middle infielder. But if they move you to the outfield, you're going to be in trouble and you're going to get stuck and you won't advance. And they'll give you 100 reasons why you're not advancing. And it's all garbage because you would advance if you were playing the position that you've been playing your whole life and that you were drafted at. So his point was that there's all types of discrimination, and some of it is overt, but a lot of it is not so overt. A lot of it is in these other things about, well, we just want to move people around to maximize their potential or whatever. And these, well, this is insidious if you look at how they do this. And there are other players talked about the paucity of Black catchers and for the same reason, and Black pitchers. And yes, there have been some Black catchers and there have been some Black pitchers, but not a lot of them. And so if you are a Black pitcher or a Black catcher, you have a tougher time because they'll keep trying to move you out of there.
Yeah. And, you know, you spoke about moving infield to outfield happens today. I believe last year, Jazz Chisholm was a infielder. He's playing center field now. And yeah, that happens a lot. And I can only think of one African-American shortstop, and that's Tim Anderson. I think that's the only one playing now. I might be wrong. There's O'Neal Cruz and a couple of people like that.
Yeah, there's a few players. Right. But I can't remember who I spoke to who brought up Tim Anderson, who said something like, you mean to tell me there's only one Black player on the planet qualified to play shortstop in the major league level? That's what you're telling me. Now think about that for a second. Think if that makes any sense to you, right? One guy, Tim Anderson, he's the only guy,
right?
He said that's absurd on its face. So there are a lot of stories like that, and it's interesting that after speaking to all these guys, when I watch a baseball game or I just look at who's playing, I look at different things now. I just notice more things than I used to notice because a lot of these things you don't notice them. You just look at the lineup. You just look at the lineup and you see Mookie Betts in the outfield and you're like, oh, okay, Mookie Betts is in the outfield. But you don't think about all the things that went on to move Mookie Betts to the outfield. And why did they move him to the outfield? And what does that mean to the person who he replaced and other players who also got moved out of position? And how does that affect the roster I'm looking at right now? Because you can't tell just by looking at the big league roster everything that went on before these players got to where they are.
Yeah. The book also has some nice illustrations. I think there's somebody might be related to you who did those. And that's Jackie Nathanson did some very nice. They're nice, like sketches, illustrations at the beginning of every chapter.
Yeah. I really love those. Obviously, it's a parental pride there. But also, I think they're good sketches, and they also serve a purpose, which I didn't anticipate at the time, but then going through the galleys and things later, I realized that they really help tell the story. And I'll tell you the story of how the sketches came to be. You typically want some sort of visual with a book like this. And usually that visual is going to be photos. There was a couple of issues with the photos because, first of all, the subject matter, minor league players that nobody's heard of, but which is by definition the subject matter of the book. Well, there's a limited value of photos. I guess they could, if they're good ones, they can be helpful. But if they're not, they're just pictures of people that nobody would recognize. But I was still going to do that. It was hard. I asked for photos from the players that I spoke to, and some of them had photos and others. It's hard to get a high-res photo. And it's hard to, if somebody's going to send you a photo, they're not going to send you the only photo they have. They're going to send you a copy of it or something. Well, you have to send a high-res copy. And it's, you know, these are older people. And it's hard. It's a lot of, we assume that everybody's familiar with the technology of how to do that. And so it was difficult. And some players were more facile with that than others. And so that became difficult. And then the other issue was, even when I could get a photo, I realized often that the player may have sent me the photo, but he didn't own the rights to the photo because he's wearing a uniform. And so it's hard to explain to somebody that, yes, this is your photo, but you actually don't own the rights to this photo. And they're like, well, it's my photo. Of course I own this photo. It's like, well, no, you own the photo. You don't own the right to the photo, because the photo depicts somebody in a uniform and that organization owns the rights, or the photographer owns the rights to that photo. And so if it was taken by your cousin, that's not a big deal, but if it is taken by a professional photographer, that the professional photographer owns the right to that photo. And how are you going to find that person? And how can you, if it's a big league player, you can call the organization and you can get the permissions from the organization. It's not that difficult to do, but these are minor league guys. And those clubs, they go through, they're affiliated with different clubs. Every few years, the affiliations change. And then also on top of that, it's not like the big league club has any of that stuff anyway. It's owned by these, it's technically owned by, I don't know, the team from, Appleton, Wisconsin, but they don't have archives that go back very far. So it's impossible to do a search to find the rights to these things. And then there's limited value. And so I came to the conclusion that this was not going to work. And there was going to be limited value, as I said. And so my daughter asked her, if she would be willing. She's done a lot of other types of sketches, which I thought were really evocative and really interesting. And I thought, well, this might work. And so what I did was I asked her to, I would give her the chapter, a chapter of a player. And then we would go through it and we would try to pick out a scene or something that would be representative of the story or something, whether it was symbolic or whether it was actual a moment. And then we would pick it. And of course, it had to be something that she could draw, that was something, so when we picked it, then she went off and she would put some sketches together and we would decide on one and sent them off to my editor, and he loved them. And then when you put them together with the chapters, I think they do a really good job of telling the story and really kind of crystallizing a moment or a thought or a feeling. And there's a lot of different ways to tell a story. And one is you could just tell it straightforward, which I hope that I did. But the other way is visually, and there's also some found poetry at the beginning of each chapter, which is another way to tell us. Mm-hmm. So all these are different ways to sort of convey the idea or the feeling.
You know, Mitch, you actually kind of hit upon it, my next question, a little bit in your explanation of the pictures, because you're talking about the minor leagues. I want to know how you actually found the 13 players that you interviewed, because one, they were minor league players. And so and I don't know how easy it is to do research on, finding African-American minor league players who might have a story to tell, or, so
here's a hint. It's impossible.
So how did you find these guys?
So, right. As you say, there's you know, there are databases of minor league players. They're not broken up by race,
right?
Thank God. But so then that's the question. Well, how do you find these guys? Because by definition, they're people you don't know. And so Bowers came to me, right? I would never have thought to talk to him. And so that after I spoke to him, I had two thoughts. One, this would be a great book. And the other one is, how am I going to find anybody? Am I going to find a bunch of people who are going to contact me out of the blue like he did? I don't think that's going to happen. So afterwards, I asked him if there were other players that he knew that would be willing to talk to me. And he said, sure, I'll give you some names. And so he did. And some of those guys were willing to talk and some of them weren't. More people were not willing to talk because, look, they don't know who I am. And these are also, very painful memories and stories. And somebody out of the blue calls them up and says, hey, you don't know me, but just spill your guts for a few hours and I'll put it in a book. I mean, not too many people are going to be comfortable enough to do that. So most of the people I spoke with didn't want to do it. But I have found that if I was introduced to the person by somebody they knew, they were more likely to be okay with it. And so that's sort of how I did it. And so, every time I would finish an interview, I would ask the person, can you give me a couple of names? And they almost always could give me a few names. And then almost always they would just volunteer to contact that person on my behalf and say, hey, this guy's going to call you or contact you. He's a good guy. You can trust him. That went very far towards my ability to even speak to these guys, because I also cold called a bunch of people and my success rate there was very, very low. And because cold call out of the blue, that's a tough ask. And so this is also a tough ask, but at least it's coming from a person they know and they feel a little more comfortable. So that's how I got to the players. Now, the problem with that is that you don't get a perfect cross section because, Mickey Bowers knows a lot of people in the Phillies organization. And my concern was that, this is going to be a book about the Phillies, which I didn't want it to be. And I had a lot more people that I could have spoken to, but they were all from the Phillies organization and I didn't want to have any more. I had to, really work to get people from different organizations, because I do think that even though the Phillies have this reputation of being particularly hostile towards Black players back then, they certainly were not an outlier. This was pretty much what was going on everywhere. And so over time, I was able to get a pretty decent cross-section of clubs represented. I'm sure they're not thrilled with that, but I thought it was important just to not make this a story about the Phillies or the Red Sox or something. So I was able to do that. I also thought it was important to get as much as I could stories from people who had different backgrounds. Not, again, a player may have grown up with this other guy, and they both played minor league ball, and he introduced me to his friend who he grew up with, and that was okay. But then, you get more than a couple of people from the same neighborhood, you want to branch out from there. That was also a challenge. And I, at the end, you get what you get. It's not perfect, but I think it certainly is representative. Think that's what I did. And, right. And people might think that's good enough or not good enough and whatever.
Well, I'll tell you, it was really good enough. It was an excellent book. The name of the book is Under Jackie's Shadow, Voices of Black Minor Leaguers, Baseball's Left Behind. And another one I wanted to ask you about is from Oakland, California. Has some pretty pretty talented sisters. His name is Aaron Pointer. And people might have
I'm heard so of excited.
The, yeah, you might have heard of the Pointer
and I can't
sisters.
Hide it.
And you know what?
He was a fascinating guy because, again, he's, his sisters are the Pointer sisters. And he also was an NFL referee, which I didn't know, which was interesting. And he also mentioned that when he was with the Colt 45s, I guess, the Houston Colt 45s, he was part of an all-rookie lineup, and which was really interesting. Rusty Staub was in that lineup, I think. And then he did make the majors, as that story indicates. He didn't play very long. And a few of these guys did play a little bit in the majors. And when I say play, I mean they got a handful of bats. I spoke to one guy, I think it's Leroy Reams, who got one at bat. And he was called up, and he was very excited that he got called up. And then it rained for a week straight. And he got a bat in one game. He struck out. And then then the rest of the week it rained. And by the end of that week, whoever he was replacing got healthy, and he got sent down again. And that was it. So he had one at bat.
Yeah. You know, another thing I noticed in the book, and you're talking about baseball players, a very small world. A lot of people know each other. And it seemed like a few of these guys that you interviewed all had some connection with Joe Morgan. I thought that was kind of interesting.
Joe Morgan and Lyman Bostock.
Yes.
Everybody seemed to have known Lyman Bostock. If you grew up in California in the late 60s, you somehow came across Lyman Bostock or Joe Morgan, right, in Oakland. Right? So, I thought that was interesting. Again, I think that was Leroy Reams, who I think played on a semi-pro team with Joe Morgan. And I think Willie Stargell was on that team. I mean, it was quite a team. I think they all worked for a Chevy dealership. And I guess this dealership would just recruit these guys for the club. You had Willie Stargell and Joe Morgan. And I think there was Larry Durker on that team? I don't know. There was another big name.
Yeah, I remember Larry Durker. Yes. Yeah. And anybody, they should really look up Lyman Bostock, who died tragically in a shooting for a car accident. And he was a terrific player for the Twins and Angels, and just cut down way too soon.
Yeah. And a lot of the players who knew him spoke very reverently about him, about what an influence he was on them and how proactive he was in helping them get to where they got. And that was another thing that I found really interesting, was that a lot of these guys, there was always somebody else who helped them navigate all of this. Because I think if you didn't have that, it was so treacherous that you wouldn't do it. And if you had a person like Bostock, again, Bostock is a guy like Allen who had this otherworldly talent. And he was able to take people with him, not literally take them with him, but he was able to get them a tryout or put them on, you know, a winter ball club or do something like that, introduce them to a scout, something like that. And when Lyman Bostock would introduce you to a scout, the scout's going to pay attention because it's Lyman Bostock. And he really was instrumental in a lot of these guys sticking with it. And I think one of the guys tells a story about Bostock, how he didn't play baseball his freshman year in college because he was involved in the civil rights protests. And then the next year he tried out, but he had, I think he had like beat up sneakers. He didn't even have a uniform or anything.
Right.
And the coach was going to throw him off the field, but he let him stay for the tryout. And he, of course, made the club and became an All-American and everything else. And as this player said, you know, you make a lot of assumptions when you look at a person first off. And you could have seen Lyman Bostock with these ripped up tennis shoes on the baseball field and thrown him right off. But what a mistake that would have been. And, you know, it just goes to show you that you really ought to take a second look before you throw somebody out, you know, because you think they don't look the part.
Mitch, when you were speaking with these players, I noticed there were, you know, there were some common themes. Of the players that you interviewed, were most bitter at baseball, or were there a couple that had gone on to have careers and whatever and were not bitter with baseball?
I think all of them had some sort of animus towards baseball. How could you not?
Right.
And I think one of the things that comes across from not everybody, but from some of them, was they had to take time away from baseball after it was done. Because if you didn't make the majors, you're almost by definition going to have an unceremonious end. You're just going to get released. You know, you're going to get ignored and then released. And it's going to be a bitter, ugly end. And particularly all the stuff that would for these guys that they went through before that to have it end like that is tough. And a lot of these guys mentioned that they for a period of time couldn't even watch a baseball, even though they grew up playing it and loving it. They couldn't watch it. But then, interestingly, I thought a lot of these guys, as time went on, sort of slowly drifted back to it. And if you talk to them now in their older age, they watch the games, they go to games, they're involved in coaching. Maybe it's coaching a youth club in their neighborhood, or they're like a hitting coach for the American Legion team, or they're doing something. A lot of these guys are, and a lot of these guys went on to do other things, basically getting jobs in the real world like the rest of us, doing whatever they do. But they did drift back. A lot of these guys drifted back to baseball. Some became, you know, Mickey Bowers was a manager in the Seattle Mariners organization during the 70s for a couple of years. Even he, you know, came back. And there was another guy, I think he coached for a couple of years in Detroit, ended up working in the Detroit organization, the Astros organization, things like that. So, and then others, you know, maybe they didn't go back officially, but they, you know, they still would have friends. The other person whose name turned up a few times was Dusty Baker. And they would mention how, you know, they played with Dusty in the minors. And I've never met Dusty Baker, but he seems to be a very good guy. He would get them tickets and he'd let them come out in the dugout before the game and walk around the clubhouse. And I can tell from a couple of the guys who mentioned that, how much that meant to them, that they were accepted in a way that they weren't all those years before. That yes, they're not fooling themselves that they're a member of, you know, the San Francisco Giants just because they're in the clubhouse, but that they're allowed, you know, a little special access and they can be treated a little bit differently than they would have if they just bought a ticket to the game. I think made them feel, it doesn't make up for anything, but it makes you feel a little better. Again, Dusty Baker, I think, seems like he's one of the good guys.
So we are speaking with professor by day, author by night, and that's Mitch Nathanson. He has written Under Jackie's Shadow, Voices of Black Minor Leaguers, Baseball Left Behind. And it's an excellent book. Highly recommend that everybody get it. But I want to just step back in the DeLorean and go back to when you were on with us with your other book, which was Boughton. And I just wanted to, well, one, we could still hype that book. We could maybe sell you a few more copies. But two, I just want to know, like, a little bit, you know, we interview the author and then sometimes we don't hear back from them for a little while. I want to know, what was life like after that book came out?
Well, that book did pretty well. I was very happy with how that book did. It probably got more publicity than this book's going to get, just because, which is a shame in a way, because, you know, Boughton, I loved Boughton. I liked him as a person, and he's an interesting guy. But people are just fascinated by Boughton for many reasons. There's a Yankee connection, the Baltimore connection, all that stuff. Whereas these guys, nobody's heard of them, which makes it a tougher sell. But yeah, the Boughton book, that book did well. A lot of people liked it. Boughton's wife didn't like it, but, you know, that's her problem. I'm glad the way it turned out. You know you did well when you have somebody pissed off at you, right? That's how you know you nailed it, right? If everybody's mad at you, that's one thing. But that, I kind of take that as a bit of a badge of honor. So, yeah, you know, I think it was the story that came out, I think, was a little different than she expected. I think she kind of thought it would be kind of like a hagiography or something. And I don't think it was certainly not bashing Boughton. Or maybe she thought it was bashing her. I don't know what she thought. Whatever. That's her issue. But anyway, I was happy with how it turned out. And a lot of people were happy with how it turned out.
So, and you came out with it during COVID and you were a member of the Pandemic Baseball Book Club, and we had a lot of those authors on, that it sold so well. And it was, you know, at that time is really a testament to how good a book it is.
Yeah, that was a tough time. I didn't know what was going to happen. I was all excited for that book to come out, and then COVID hit, and then everything just went to hell. And so that's that Pandemic Baseball Book Club started. And I was fortunate to be one of the early members of that group, which was great because that was a real lifesaver that helped a lot. And, you know, you had to really figure it out on the fly. How are you going to do this? How are you going to promote this? How are you going to, you know, how are you going to get the word out that this book is even out there? you know, that was a big help. Being in the New York Times never hurts. So that was a big help. You know, at the end, it worked out pretty well. I wouldn't wish that situation on anybody. But I think it turned out pretty well, given all of those obstacles that were unexpected and really at the very last minute, because the book came out in April and this all happened in March, like 3 weeks before. Not a lot of time to prepare.
Well, you know, for this book, Under Jackie's Shadow, and you can require all your students to buy the book. That'll get you some sales. Mitchell, this has been an interview. I mean, this is a great book. Please, everybody, go out and get it and tell people where they can go get it.
You can get it anywhere books are sold, which is online somehow. You can get it on Amazon or Barnes & Noble or your local bookstore. Order it. You can order from your local bookstore. You can order it from University of Nebraska Press directly. But again, wherever you buy books, that's where it will be.
And do you have any social media where people can follow you or ask you questions or anything like that?
Well, I got off Twitter, so you can contact me there.
Okay.
Although I think my account is still up, but I don't look at it. So.
But you have a website.
Yeah, MitchellNathanson.com. So you can go there. You can find me on Facebook. I'm there. Those are only two things. I don't really do Instagram. Mm-hmm. I think if you're over the age of 35, Instagram's a tough go. So I see some people are very good at it. I'm not very good at it, but I'm good. I can do Facebook. And again, my website, you can always reach me there. Or I'm very easy. If you just Google me, it's very easy to find my email, unfortunately. But but it's not that tough. It's funny because, you know, after Bouton came out, I on the one hand, I was very, very flattered to get a lot of emails from people who had read the book or wanted to talk about the book. And that was terrific. But there's always a few people who want to point out all the little things that they think you did wrong or you got whatever, but which is fine. Everybody, you know, people, if they're excited about a book and they're, you know, they want to engage, that means that it must have touched them somehow. And so those are all good. So I like any of that.
Well, thank you very much for joining us on Baseball and BBQ, Mitchell. We wish you the best of success. And next time you write another baseball book, come on the show.
Yeah, probably another 4 years.
Okay.
Make sure you put us in the credits or something. We we need all that's the credits right. You get.
That's right. Yeah, you and me both.
Thank you very much, Mitchell.
Thanks so much, Mitchell.
Thank you.
Hi, this is Gary Mack of the Mets Musings podcast. And if you like barbecue and you like baseball, then you have to listen to Baseball and BBQ with Jeff and Lynn. They always have the best guests from the world of baseball and the world of barbecue, all in one little package. So check it out. Baseball and BBQ with Lynn and Jeff. Okay, guys, take it away.
And thank you, Mitchell Nathanson. That was a fantastic interview and just like I said, important book that everybody should get.
Everybody should get that book. And like we said before, that would definitely make a good Father's Day gift. But along with that book, we have Ray Sheehan, who will be coming up with the gift guide. But before we do, Jeff... And, you know, it's funny because Ray, I don't want to let reveal too much, but let's just say that the items that we're about to talk about might be on his list. And that is baseballbbq.com for grilling tools and accessories, baseball bat handle tools. I mean, we talk about it. We love it. Ray has it on his list. If that's not enough to convince you, go to baseballbbq.com. You're going to love what you find there.
Absolutely. And now
it's time for the baseball quote of the week.
Baseball is our passion. We talk about it 12 months out of the year. We care about it. We look forward to it. That was Hall of Famer Cal Ripken Jr.
Wow. That's a great quote. You know, for a minute, Jeff, I thought you were going to say it was your quote because it's fans too. As we are. And what do we do 12 months of the year?
And before we get to Ray, we just want to remind everybody to call the show at 516-855-8214. Email us, baseballandbbq@gmail.com. Leave a comment on our Facebook page, Baseball and BBQ. We have an X at Baseball and BBQ, Instagram, Baseball and Barbecue, where barbecue is all spelled out. And our website is www.baseballandbbq.weebly.com. Please rate, review, follow, subscribe.
Tell your friends. And your friends. Know, Jeff, as you were just reading how to get in touch with the show, I realized what the worst thing about Twitter becoming X is.
What's that?
I can no longer go tweet, tweet.
Well, that's one of the benefits.
Actually, you love it. That's probably the best benefit to you. But I still want to listen to Ray, Chef Ray, as he gives his list of barbecue gift guide ideas. You know what, Jeff? I still need to know what to buy you. So I better listen. Here's Ray. Baseball and barbecue listeners, I'm not really sure in what capacity we should say he's here tonight. Sometimes he's a guest host correspondent. Sometimes he's the guest. Tonight, I guess he's both. You will know him as the great Chef Ray. We know him as our friend of the show. He came to us back at the end of 2023 with his holiday edition. Of course, he's a holiday gift edition. Of course, he's been on since then. But now, Chef Ray is back with his Father's Day gift list for 2024. If you were wondering what to buy the dad, the father in your life, you have nothing to worry about. All you've got to worry about is how to buy the stuff. But you don't need to know what to buy because Chef Ray is about to tell you. Chef Ray, welcome. Ray.
Hey, guys. Thank you for having me on once again. Really good to see you.
Hello, I'm just laughing because Jeff's like, come on, Leonard. This is getting long.
Well, Chef, we've got a Ray, lot of Ray. Good stuff to talk about today.
Father's Day.
When is Father's Day?
June 16th.
So
yes,
we have Father's Day coming up, and you have some great gift ideas for us, don't you, Chef Ray?
I do. We're talking, all things live fire today. We have grills, we have accessories, sauces, rubs, everything that you're going to need to get your barbecue started and to get the father figure in your life something great for outdoor cooking.
And Ray, before you get started, one of the things that I saw when I was perusing the list is that you have every cost, you have for where you're not spending a lot, maybe you're spending a little more, but you have for every, maybe you have little kids and they want to buy their dad, a gift, but their allowance, what do they get, a quarter a week now, kids? And this way they could buy something. And then maybe you have a wife that wants to buy her dad something. There's her dad or her husband, whatever. So Ray, take it away. Take us to your list.
Well, like you said, we try to hit all the different price points and all the different types of things that you might want to get your dad or your father figure, the griller in your life for Father's Day. Starting off kind of like an old standby, but something, the Big Green Egg Mini Max. It's small, it's mighty, it's portable. You're going to take it tailgating. It comes in at around almost 80 pounds. It's almost 20 inches high. It's a heavy-duty workhorse, and you can grill. You can smoke. It's a convection oven all-in-one. You can cook everything from pizza, brisket, baked goods, and it's really perfect for your next tailgate or to go camping.
Excellent. Sounds very portable.
Yeah. It sounds very portable. I am loving my Minimax. It's very durable. It's a little heavy. You may need a hand to move it from place to place, but it is definitely very portable and really great for a tailgate.
Excellent.
Okay. And Ray, you've got the website is biggreenegg.com for people that want to know where they could see more of these, of the Big Green Egg, of the Minimax.
Oh yeah. And they'll have everything on there, all the accessories for the eggs. And then you'll see all the different sizes too.
All right. Excellent. What's next?
Oh, next. So if you're not into charcoal cooking and you are into pellets, the Pit Boss Austin XL Onyx Edition. This is a fan favorite wood pellet grill, and I'm going to say it really brings the heat. And the reason I say that is because it'll allow you to easily maintain your temperature if you want to do low and slow cooking. But it also has this really unique feature. It has an adjustable flame broil lever, which allows for direct flame searing up to 1,000 degrees. And with more than 1,000 square inches of cooking space, you can easily host the crowd or serve up just dinner for two. You know, it's also backed by the Pit Boss best-in-class 5-year warranty. So if you're kind of hesitant to get a pellet smoker because you've heard stories of people having trouble with the auger, they stand behind their products. They're very customer-oriented, and it's a 5-year warranty. PitBossGrills.com. This is one you don't want to miss. That makes a great gift.
Excellent. And what's the next one on the list here?
So if you are a griddler and you love to cook outside, a lot of people like myself started with the Blackstone, but this is the Halo Elite 1B outdoor griddle. Whether you're camping, tailgating, just cooking up a meal in your backyard, this is the perfect cooking companion for all your outdoor adventures. Things that make it different from like a Blackstone or other brands, this is really a higher end griddle. It's got a windproof design. Its features include a leveler, patent-pending squeegee, a warming rack, extra-large rear grease management system, and it's got a signature burner system. It's got one burner but two zones. And this comes in a few different sizes, but I thought this small portable one would be great if you want to take it to your campsite, to your trailer. They're calling it the ultimate outdoor griddle, and I can see why. Halo also makes pellet grills, but I love their griddles. So Halo, it's halo-pg.com, Halo Elite Outdoor Griddle.
I love how you call it if you're a griddler.
If you're a griddler, and this, you can get into this. This is like, it is the portable one, but it's I think they're $299 on most of these websites. For $299, I mean, you have this elite griddle that you can take with you everywhere you go. So, and like I said, it does have a lot more features than some of the other ones. So definitely wanted to get that on the list for Father's Day.
Excellent. And your last grill on your list is what?
So for the last grill, Primal Grills USA, award-winning pitmaster Harry Sue and his team, they set out to create the ultimate live fire cooking experience, and it looks like they have. The first release from this line is the Live Fire 40 model. It boasts commercial grade 304 stainless. We had Harry Sue on the show not that long ago. We talked all about it, and it is really an awesome grill. Its sidewalls and doors are insulated with the Sarah wool, a commercial grade ceramic wool designed for high temperature applications up to 1300 degrees. I mean, it makes it lightweight. It's got the Sear and Flow J grates that not only create the perfect diamond grill marks on your meats, but they also catch the drippings and channel them away to prevent flare ups. So this is a really high end grill. This is something you can build into your outdoor kitchen. It can also be on its own on its own cart. It's primalgrillsusa.com.
And Ray, when we did have Harry on, he did say he went, if you want me to test your grill, that's fine. And you want me to be part of it, the sales, that's fine. But you're going to make these changes. They have to meet my specifications. And he was rigid. I am sure that grill is going to be a good one.
Absolutely. I mean, he's even has a place on the grill to put his mise en place, everything ready to cook. So yeah, it's very well thought out. And if you are in the market for a high-end grill that has it all, primalgrillsusa.com.
Yeah, can't do it any better than Harry Sue there, that's for sure. So now going down your list, you have a rubs and sauces section. So this, we love rubs and sauces. So tell us about these.
Slap Yo Daddy Barbecue, championship sauces and rubs, expertly crafted by award-winning pitmaster Harry Sue. He was
wait a minute,
to-
Harry Sue,
but Harry Sue.
Harry Sue has Primal Grills. Harry Sue again. He's amazing.
Harry, Harry Sue's the man. He spread the barbecue love. We got to try some of his award-winning sauces and rubs. Really fantastic on pretty much everything I've put them on. I mean, I haven't found a bad one yet, and I don't think I'm going to. Really delicious. And they're loaded with umami, a lot of umami flavor and unique ingredients. You know, the different powders that are in there. They're really fantastic. So slapyodaddybbq.com, Harry Sue.
Very nice. Yeah. Harry is the busiest retiree I know.
Yeah. I mean, he doesn't stop moving. He's spreading the barbecue love.
Barbecue love.
Exactly right, Glenn. Yeah. Exactly right.
All right. Tell us another sauces and rubs. Go ahead. What's next?
When I first got into barbecue, one of the first people that I got to meet was Barbecue Bob, Pitmaster Bob Trudnack. He's got some fantastic sauces and seasonings. He has two companies, Barbecue Bob's Having a Barbecue and Bobby T's. Bobby T's is his line of pizza seasonings and, you know, dough and sauce. I mean, I talk about someone who doesn't sleep. He's got all the barbecue covered. He's got all the outdoor cooking and the pizza ovens covered. Bob is an award-winning pitmaster. He's known for his precision grilling and his passion for crafting elevated cuisine. They've helped him build these two amazing brands. Go to bobtrudnack.com, BOBTRUDNAK.com, and check out some of these award-winning sauces and rubs.
Absolutely. Go to bobtrudnack.com. And right, the next one is Sweet Heat Sauces and Rubs. I think I met this guy, Damond Mullen.
Damond, yes, we met him.
In Atlantic City.
That's right.
Yes.
The same day that we met Ray, we met Damond, yes.
So tell us about the Sweet Heat Sauces and Rubs.
Sweet Heat Sauces and Rubs, created by founder and owner of Streetside Barbecue, Damond Mullen. Sweet Heat is based in Willow Grove, Pennsylvania. His barbecue products are sold at many local retailers, including DeBruni Brothers, Weaver's Way, Kimmerton Whole Foods, and many more. Sweet Heat products are all natural with multiple layers of flavor that start off sweet and they end with a mild, flavorful touch of heat. Really delicious. Go to sweetheat.com.
So now, okay, so we've got grills on the list, sauces and rubs on the list. Now, what else do I, is that all I need for my barbecue?
No, I think you need some really delicious curated accessories.
Ah,
curated accessories. I like it.
Curated. Yeah. Yes. I mean, you know, we really try to spotlight a lot of the companies. There are some big companies, but we do. And the big companies that we feature, I feel like they give back to their communities in many ways, like Big Green Egg does with holding events, and Pit Boss gives back to the communities in which they do business. But a lot of these are mom and pop shops, you know, right. Damond, Barbecue Bob, Slap Your Daddy. These are all small, so we like to show them some love. So our first accessory, Forged to Table. These are the finest Japanese-style knives developed by industry professionals. They're handcrafted by third-generation bladesmiths. I love mine. I use mine to break down brisket. I cut, like, tuna loins. I cut everything. These knives, they don't get dull. They last. They're easy to clean. And they're super sharp. And you know what? They're really affordable. Where else can you go? Every knife is handcrafted. They're individually made. ForgeToTable.com. Definitely get a thumbs up. And definitely check them out.
And started by an alumni of Johnson & Wales University, who I'm kind of partial to. So,
yeah. Yeah, I mean, it's a mom and pop business. It's not, you know, I mean, they're just trying to make it, and they're doing a great job. So I want to support them.
Noah Rosen was a guest on the show. Thanks to you, Ray. I mean, many of these companies have been on the show, and we appreciate it. His products are excellent. And knives are one of the things that you just can't have enough of, I guess, but you certainly can't do without. Try cutting a brisket with, you know, with something other than a knife.
Right. And you know, like I say, in social media, there's a lot of food on the internet, and not all of it's great. It's kind of the same with knives. There's a million people trying to sell you knives on the internet. I get people all the time in my direct messages. Oh, look, I have knives. But these are hand-forged knives. They're like one is more gorgeous than the next. And they're really affordable. They're mm-hmm. not like trying to kill you on the price. So that's why I said, you know what? They're really trying to get their products out there, and they do a good job the way that they produce them, the way they make them. They use sustainable practices for their employees as well as for the customers. And the price point is really terrific. So forgetotable.com.
And Ray, may I say that this is a Father's Day guide, but this would make a great wedding gift. Since June Absolutely. Is the month of weddings, this will make a great wedding gift for any couple starting their lives together.
Yeah, and the knives come in these really great wooden, you know, boxes that are like kind of keepsake. Really, they do make a great gift.
Your next item here on the accessories is the meter, and I got to tell you, I used my meter the other day, and I love my meter.
Yeah, push your culinary limits to the next level with Meter 2 Plus, the newest smart tool to upgrade your kitchen arsenal. I mean, this thing is great. It features really high temperature limits. It's stronger. It's more robust. It has a longer range than its predecessors. This thermometer really boasts precision calibration. It's fast charging, and it's 100% waterproof. It just makes it so much easier.
And it's wireless. You probably said that. It's wireless, right? So you know when it really has a use? I mean, has a lot of uses, but when you're making rotisserie, anything on the rotisserie, you need wireless, obviously, because when it's, you know, you can't have a wire on there. It's perfect for when you're making rotisserie chicken, whatever you're making on the rotisserie.
Even for, it takes high heat too. So if you want to sear, a tomahawk steak or a nice thick steak, I mean, it's going to give you just a really good precision temperature. It's going to withstand the heat. Rotisserie cooking, I mean, indoors or out, the meter 2 Plus, you don't want to be cooking without it.
Exactly.
So go to mmeter.com.
And next item on your list, I think we've heard of this company, but why don't you tell us about it?
They are near and dear to our hearts.
I can see why. With a name like Baseball BBQ Tools, I can see why. Bringing these two great pastimes together, these guys and gals build tools for fans of the game and the grill. What more can I say? You want a custom gift? They'll engrave the bat handles. They'll engrave the home plate shaped cutting boards. They're in your corner. Whatever you need, they definitely would make your Father's Day great with some of their products.
Absolutely. And what's the perfect draft BBQ blower 4.0?
So that's kind of like, I don't know if you recall like what the barbecue gurus were or still are. It's kind of like a fan system. The perfect draft barbecue blower, whether you're a seasoned pitmaster or a backyard grilling enthusiast, this blower offers precision control over your charcoal grill or offset reverse flow smoker's airflow and the temperature. It features a long battery life and it lasts over 17 hours on a single charge. So when I used to have a big tow behind offset smoker, Big Meadow Creek, and I would take it to an event, and I had the perfect draft, but I had the 2.0 at the time, and it was fantastic. I mean, it would connect to the firebox on my cooker, and it would basically, I would set the temperature, and it would just keep stoking the fire for me. It really makes your pit a set it and forget it type of pit, even especially, you know, for these, for the bigger pits. Mm-hmm. The perfect draft is really an awesome tool. I know if you're an old fashioned barbecue guy, some people don't like to use these types of tools, but I think more and more people realize the benefit of them, and it just makes your life easy. And the perfect draft barbecue blower is really the way to go if you have a big offset pit.
Ray, so is
go
that
to theperfectdraft.com. Sorry about that.
No, I'm sorry. I wanted to ask you about that because so I know that like ThermoWorks makes something called Billows, which you could use for your Kamado cooker and the Weber Smoky Mountain. What specifically are the smokers that you can use this for, or do they make different ones for different smokers?
So, like for the Big Green Egg, they have the Egg Genius, barbecue guru, that temperature, you know, fan system can go on a lot of different smokers, but where the perfect draft really shines is it puts out enough CFMs for the big smokers, for like the big offsets. You know, it really has the power to control the temps on those, where a lot of these other ones, either they don't have enough power to do it, or you need like two fans to do it. The perfect draft is just one. They've updated their packaging. They've streamlined their production. And I think we're going to see a lot more from the perfect draft barbecue blower going forward into the next year. Perfect draft, theperfectdraft.com.
And the last item on your list, and it's a veteran owned company, which we love to do business with. So why don't you tell us about Fifth and Sherry?
Well, we've talked about knives. We've talked about thermometers. We've talked about pretty much everything. But what Fifth and Sherry has to offer is, yes, they are a veteran-owned company, but they make these beautiful handcrafted in the United States cutting boards. They're 100% responsibly sourced cherry wood. Each board comes with a lifetime warranty that includes complimentary refinishing for life, which means that this is the last cutting board that you're ever going to have to buy. And really incredible. I mean, these are like works of art, but mm-hmm. they're also functional. I think that it would make a really fantastic gift. I know I would be happy to get one of these for Father's Day.
Or yes, any day. And it can also be personalized too. I've seen them carve something into the side of the cutting board. So it's a great company. Yes. Well, Ray, thank you very much for the gift ideas, the Father's Day gift guide. And this will be available. Tell us where people can get this list if they want to take a look at it.
So the gift guide will be published in Barbecue News Magazine in June. Should be on the smokesheet.com, you know, for the barbecue newsletter, the smokesheet, as well as on my Facebook page, Chef Ray Sheehan on Facebook. It's my professional page. I'll be posting it there. And then should be posted on the Baseball and Barbecue Podcast website as well.
Oh, yeah. Yeah, we can do that. Yeah.
Why not?
And
we're gonna spread the barbecue love.
Yes.
Absolutely. And Ray, before we let you go, do you have anything you might want to tell us about you and your, as they say, barbecue journey, and what's cooking with Chef Ray?
Lots of exciting things coming up. I was hoping to come on and talk to you about them.
Oh, okay. If you want to save it.
Well, by the time this airs, I'll already have done a couple of those things. So I will hold off. And we got a lot of stuff cooking at raysheehan.com. It's going to be opening soon. So we'll keep you. Stay tuned to that.
All right. We're looking forward to it. Yes, we will have you on. I shouldn't mix the gift list with Chef Ray's business. So we will have you separate with that. But right now, Ray, this is a great list. You know, Jeff, you know what I realized as he's doing this list? This is a list of all the things I won't be getting for Father's Day.
You have some of this stuff already, though.
I know. No, I'm just kidding. No, it's a fantastic list. There were a couple of things on there that actually I wasn't even aware of, and I kind of do want them now. I'm not saying what, because I don't want everyone to hear that, and then they'll all run out because we're influencers. You know what I mean?
Okay. Well, there's something for everyone, I feel like, on this list. Like I said, we've covered if you wanted to give a small gift, a medium gift, a large gift, something that's going to be passed down from generation to generation, whether it's a knife or a cutting board or perhaps a grill. I mean, I think we've covered a lot of ground here.
We have.
And I think Father's Day is a good time, whether it's your father figure, whoever that key person is in your life, if they're a griller, a griddler, a smoker, I think we got something for them. So.
And so then the last thing that I would like to say is, Ray, thank you. And I want to wish you, I know it's early, but I want to wish you a very happy Father's Day.
Thank you so much. And happy Father's Day to you guys. Hopefully The weather's nice and we're all out there grilling.
Excellent. Thanks a lot, Ray.
Thank you.
Thank you very much, Ray. That is a great gift guide. I guarantee you're not going to be unhappy with any of the items purchased on that list. So whoever is celebrating Father's Day, whoever you're celebrating it with, have a wonderful Father's Day. Hope we were able to help with our gift guide. Jeff, I want to wish you a happy Father's Day in advance.
No, thank you, because it's in 2 weeks. Happy Father's Day to you.
Thank you very much. And you know what? We are brought to you by Bet Online. It is where the game starts. But as I like to say, what do I say, Jeff?
We're not starting.
We're ending, because we've done a lot of show. So how do we end the show, Jeff?
With the musician.
That is Dave Dresser.
And the song.
What about the poet?
I was going to get to the poet. And the poet.
Shel Krakowski. And the song, before I get to that, let me just wish the two of them a wonderful Father's Day. And now the song is Baseball Always Brings You Home.
We'll see you next time on episode 242.
Stay.